The Guardian.
Hi, I'm Jim Folzerano, and welcome to the Guardian Weekly Podcast for May 7th, 2008, bringing you news and analysis of key events from around the globe. This week, devastation in Burma in the aftermath of the cyclone.
People say that once the floodwaters receded, many villages were just gone along the coast.
Rory Carroll in the middle of the riots in Bolivia.
If you want a sign of just how polarized Bolivia has become, this is it.
And the perils of dog walking in Beijing. A powerful cyclone has devastated parts of Burma, wiping out entire villages and leaving millions of people homeless and under threat from waterborne diseases. I spoke with The Guardian's Ian McKinnon in neighboring Thailand to find out the latest.
Well, the latest developments are that the death toll and the number of missing has increased dramatically again. It started off very low over the weekend after the cyclone hit Rangoon and the southwest of the country on Friday night and Saturday. And for several days, there was very little word of damage and particularly the number of dead or missing.
Why such a high death toll? Can you explain to our listeners why so many people were killed?
It seems a particular problem. The area worst affected is the Irrawaddy Delta, which is a very low-lying area to the south and southwest of the main city, Rangoon. When you look at it on a map, it's many, many inlets of water from the sea, from the Bay of Bengal, and the whole area is very low-lying. So the problem with the cyclone was that the winds of 120 miles an hour whipped up huge seas, a storm surge of at least 12 feet and possibly up to 20, some people say. And this brought a huge amount of water inland over this very low-lying area where also the problem, people live in flimsy bamboo houses which were either blown away or swept away over a huge area. There are 7 million people that live in this delta alone.
So it was almost like a tsunami in effect.
To some extent, yes, it was huge. People say that once the floodwaters receded, many villages were just gone along the coast and the whole area and what remained was just covered in mud.
Sure, swept away, as you say. So what are the most pressing needs now?
Aid agencies are still desperately trying to get to the area to assess the scale of the damage. There are quite a number of towns where there have been really no reports have been received from them so far.
What do you read into the government's admission here? Because as you know, the regime is sometimes suspicious of outside interference.
It is suspicious of outside interference and particularly international aid agencies. It seems at this time that even they have realized that the magnitude of this problem is overwhelming for a government that's already patchy at best. And they do seem to acknowledge that they need outside help. I think the terms of reference are still being debated in meetings with aid agencies and government ministries in the country at the moment, and it remains to be seen. Obviously, the aid agencies want to get their workers, their international workers, and their relief supplies in as quickly as possible. But that seems to be still taking some time at the moment, despite a willingness by some in the government to do that. Those aid agencies who are working on the ground say that they are being able to move quite freely. So that's one positive in this.
Sure. Now, after the initial impact, the people being swept away, what are the main dangers now?
The main dangers, the aid agencies are extremely concerned that there is a lack of shelter. Some believe that as many as a million people might be homeless at the moment. There's very little clean drinking water. And so the fear very much is of waterborne diseases among the survivors. After that, of course, they need food and they need things like mosquito nets because of the very tropical climate and the onset of the rainy season at the moment.
Ian McKinnon from Bangkok, thank you very much. A referendum in Bolivia seems to have done nothing except deepen divisions between people in the resource-rich region of Santa Cruz and poorer indigenous supporters of the country's president, Evo Morales. The Guardian's Latin America correspondent, Rory Carroll, found himself in the middle of rioting at one polling station, where opponents of the poll were employing a method Bolivians often use to discourage voting.
If you want a sign of just how polarized Bolivia has become, this is it. A crowd of hundreds of indigenous people, all armed with sticks, rocks, clubs, metal rods, bottles, tree branches, pretty much everything they can get their hands on, are now attacking a voting center. They're hurling... That sounds you hear are men trying to smash open the door to get inside. They want to burn the ballot boxes. And meantime, the people cowering inside are hurling rocks and everything they can out over the walls to hit the people on the other side. The protesters are inside. It's total chaos. They're smashing windows, hurling bottles at everything they can find. They're hurling rocks and bricks. There's a handful of police here with riot shields and tear gas, but it's not enough to control the situation. Those sounds you hear of people trying to smash down doors, they're doing a pretty good job of it. One of the protesters and I got a ballot box. He's holding it up as a trophy. He's holding it up as a trophy, now he's smashing it. Meantime, rocks are raising down. So here we go again. After a break for lunch, there's the mob has gathered. They're trying to try to get another school or a voting center. So there's about 200 guys, again with rocks, sticks, metal rods, firecrackers, and they're facing off against a group of people who are trying to defend the voting center. Storming another voting center. This time the police are slightly better organized and they're firing tear gas. So everybody's got their own little canister of vinegar and a little cloth wrapped around their face. One of the convenient things about Bolivia from a rioter's point of view is there's always something nearby you can pick up and throw. There's rubble, dirt, junk, chopped wood, everywhere. It's a whole armory just right at your feet. The pro-autonomy people have retaken the school and in the process have captured and very badly beaten one of the anti-autonomy protesters. He's a young man, his face is totally bloodied. He's obviously traumatized. The throng are now marching him off to somewhere. Half of them seem to want to kill him and the other half seem to want to save him. The people who want to vote in the referendum are furious. They've just been attacked by a mob. They've now emerged from the voting centres to see if they can try to defend themselves. At which point now the riot police have belatedly intervened and seem to be siding with the rioters. It's these are pro-government police, and the rioters in this case are also supporters of the government. What appears to be one of the pro-autonomy guys has now opened fire on the indigenous people. He and his group have now turned tail. They're sprinting. The protesters are in pursuit. There's a large gang of guys with sticks and rocks chasing him.
Well, since Rory Carroll recorded that, he's been talking to Guardian Daily's Belinda Rhodes. And she started by asking him why feelings were running so high.
Feelings were running high because the indigenous community feels that there's so much at stake here. They feel that the referendum was an attempt to ring-fence Santa Cruz province away from the central government, which they support, because the central government is headed by President Evo Morales, who's the first indigenous president in the country, and they feel that he's making very bold efforts to spread the country's wealth and power to indigenous communities. So the fact that this wealthy province of paler-skinned Bolivians is now trying to ring-fence itself from that process. It's enraged these indigenous communities in Santa Cruz, and that's why they went rioting.
So what's going to happen now? The president has rejected the vote. How are the people of Santa Cruz going to respond to that?
It's a wait-and-see situation at the moment. We're watching to see whether the Santa Cruz authorities, who've now claimed this crushing mandate for autonomy, how far and how fast they're going to push that mandate. For instance, are they going to try to create their own police force? Are they going to try to take control of the gas fields here? And so forth. And also we're watching to see how President Evo Morales will respond. Will he hold out
an olive branch of sorts and sit down and talk to his foes and try to hammer out some form of compromise? Or will the two sides just continue basically shouting at each other, and then that'll feed out to street level and allow people to continue rioting? My money is on some form of compromise, some form of messy compromise, which will actually cool the temperature.
And are any other regions of Bolivia expected to take this kind of action?
Yes, there are another three regions near Santa Cruz that are also due to hold their own autonomy referendums. And just as in Santa Cruz, they're expected to pass overwhelmingly. And that's one of the reasons why it's very possible that Evo Morales will compromise, because he just needs to talk to these guys, because if he doesn't, this form of rebellion just threatens to derail his whole project, which is trying to spread pro-indigenous and kind of pro-socialist and some would say populist economic policies across the country. Now, if he doesn't somehow defuse this autonomy rebellion, then that project will just be blown out of the water.
That was Belinda Rhodes talking to Rory Carroll. Coming up later in the program, Kate Connolly tells us about the mood in Austria after the Fritzl scandal. And as the 60th anniversary of the State of Israel draws near, Rory McCarthy visits a house in Jerusalem with a very particular history. Sharply rising prices for many staple foodstuffs have caused rioting in some places, such as Somalia, and led many people to question how the world will react to the prospect of food shortages. Professor Ian Schoons of the Institute of Development Studies comments on the global food crisis and sees it as an opportunity as well as a challenge.
It certainly hit us by surprise, and the fact that urban consumers are on the streets in a number of countries has really raised the stakes, I think. As a number of people have said over recent weeks, between 100 and 200 million people globally are at risk for being pushed back into poverty as a result of these food price hikes. So there's an immediate short-term issue here which has to be dealt with in particular ways by focusing in on social safety nets and social protection measures.
Any sense that why would this is such a surprise? I mean, it does seem to have caught most people on the hop, certainly government officials. Why was it not foreseen?
The dramatic nature of the hikes came as a result of a number of interacting things that we probably couldn't have predicted. A series of crop failures in different parts of the world, the massive shift of maize in particular to biofuels in the United States, and a certain amount of speculation and collusion in the markets resulted in the spike. But actually, there's been a much longer-term trend that I think that a number of people have commented on, but we haven't reacted to in a systemic manner as yet. The more longer-term issues center around the long-term impacts of climate change, the changing pattern of demand as people, particularly in Asia, become richer, and indeed in parts of Africa, urban Africa, consuming more food, transferring more of it through the livestock system and so on. So the match between demand and supply has got out of kilter, and the long-term trend of downward prices, which started in the 1950s and have continued more or less unabated except for the spike in the early 70s due to the energy crisis in that period, energy crisis and a series of droughts, is on the turn. This is something that's going to be with us for a while. And although this particular peaking now may go away, the longer-term pattern is most likely to be a substantial increase in food prices.
Sure. Now, you did mention the demand for meat in particular, India and China, certainly. Those people are going to want their aspirational lifestyle, and it's going to be very difficult to persuade them that they can't have it. So if that's the case, how does the rest of the world cope with that increasing demand?
It requires responding on the supply side. And, you know, historically, farmers globally have been very good at responding. And I'm sure we'll do so this time as well. But the key is to match the supply and demand. There may be plenty of food around, but it doesn't get to the right people in the right places. This is what Amartya Sen talked about, the entitlement problem and the challenge of hunger. And that's something that we really are going to be facing. We do have to address the production side, for sure, the basic supply, but we also have to address the broader questions of entitlements and getting markets working, getting supply systems working. And that will, in the longer term, if we get that all right, drive prices down or at least stabilize them, and we'll be back in a situation where we can cope and not have to be in this emergency situation, which we are in now. But that does require some substantial investment, particularly in places like sub-Saharan Africa.
Let's play crystal ball for just a moment. At 20 years' time, how will the patterns of food consumption change, assuming that we're not able to do the things that you're advising?
Well, I think that, you know, the patterns of food consumption will continue to reflect the changing structural features of the global economy, i.e. the growth of Asia, the growth of urban Africa, and so on. I have a more positive view about the prospects in sub-Saharan Africa. I think in many respects this food price crisis at the moment is a wake-up call, which I think will be responded to. There are plenty of success stories across sub-Saharan Africa which suggest that it's perfectly possible to get the ingredients right for a new African Green Revolution. So I think that actually this may be quite a key moment. For sure, there are issues to be dealt with in terms of feeding hungry people in as consumers. But I think the farmers will almost certainly rise to the challenge, and that the type of investments that are needed will be forthcoming. So I have a more positive view than some, potentially a wake-up call.
That was Professor Ian Schoons of the Institute of Development Studies. After a week of reporting the story of Joseph Fritzl in the underground chamber where he kept his daughter Elizabeth, The Guardian's Kate Connolly is reminded of another story she covered in Iraq, and another victim of the passage of subterranean time.
What might it mean to have 24 years stolen from your life? I pondered the question last Monday, having scrambled to get on the first possible plane to Vienna to report on the discovery of someone who had spent that length of time locked up in an underground prison. Dragged from her bed by her father in the dead of night in the summer of 1984, Elizabeth Fritzl had since then neither seen sunlight, felt the breeze on her skin, or heard birdsong. In 1984, I thought, I was 12. The highlights of my year were a 14-mile sponsored walk, reading George Orwell's eponymous novel, getting my first aid badge at Guides, and enjoying the Olympic triumph of ice dancers Torval and Dean. I was somewhat jolted out of my own small world by a few other events as well, like the start of the miners' strike, the assassination of Indira Gandhi, and the dramatic demise of Tommy Cooper while performing live on television. In terms of world events and social and technological developments, an absolute age has passed since then. But for Elizabeth Fritzl, that was when life ground to a halt. That is only one aspect of this story I still find it very hard to comprehend, even after well over a week of reporting on it for The Guardian, day in, day out. During what has been an intense week, which has seen me dashing between press conferences, interviews with police officers and psychiatrists, and the unavoidable grey monstrosity on Ibbs Street, which Fritzl called the family home, but which is arguably much more akin to Colditz, I have been frequently reminded of another story from another world, of another captive, which I covered almost exactly 5 years ago. In Iraq, reporting on the aftermath of the invasion, I was given a tip-off by a man who told me a local had just emerged from a 1-metre-wide, 1.5-metre-high concrete cell that he had built beneath his mother's kitchen in the village of Onamaniya 21 years earlier, a self-imposed exile which had helped the Shiite scholar Jawad Amir Syed survive capture by Saddam Hussein's agents. When I heard that Elizabeth had lost all her teeth due to vitamin D deficiency, I was reminded of Juad, who showed me the matchbox in which he had preserved his teeth, as well as the plastic bag full of years of his beard clippings. The words of the bird-like 45-year-old came back to me. "I was a fit young man when I first took refuge. Now I am withered and old," he said. They could be those of Elizabeth, who is said to look 2 decades older than her 42 years. The pretty brunette figure she was in 1984, now white-haired, shrunken, and wrinkled. I was somewhat taken aback when I heard Austria's Chancellor Alfred Gusenbauer say he was planning to launch a PR campaign to improve his country's damaged image ahead of the Euro 2008 Championships, which Austria will co-host next month. His words came across as cold and corporate in the light of what had happened. "Wouldn't it make more sense," a newspaper asked, "to start looking for answers to this within ourselves instead of reacting in a patriotic, knee-jerk way?" My heart did go out, though, to the manager of the hotel I stayed in the centre of Amstetten. When I was checking out, her eyes filled with tears. "I hope we'll meet again in better times," she said. "I just feel so ashamed of what has happened and wonder whether we'll ever be able to recover."
That was The Guardian's Kate Connolly. The past of one piece of property in West Jerusalem tells you all you need to know about the deep divisions between Palestinians and Israelis. As Israel prepares for its 60th birthday this week, Rory McCarthy visits the Halak House and explains how it symbolizes the tragic rift between two peoples.
This is the story of a house in a smart district of West Jerusalem. It was built in the early 1930s from golden blocks of stone and has an arched central doorway and tall palm trees in the garden. Two families with competing histories, one Palestinian, one Israeli, have called this house their home. One family has a story of flight and dispossession, the other a story of immigration and achievement. This is the legacy of 1948, the year celebrated this week in Israel as the 60th anniversary of the founding of the state, but a year marked in a much more somber way by Palestinians as the beginning of their refugee crisis. In 1948, this house was home to the grandparents and uncles and aunts of Wilhelmine Baramki, a Christian Palestinian who was 13 years old at the time. She has clear memories of long summers spent playing in the house.
There were fruit trees also, a nice apple tree, a swing. There was a swing where we used to play on the swing. You know, those memories, that was for us something.
In 1948, a brewing conflict broke out into war between the Jews and their Arab neighbors.
My father told my mother, I can't keep going, we'll be shot one day.
When the fighting reached their part of Jerusalem, Wilhelmine and her family took the clothes they could carry and fled, imagining they would only be away for a short time. But days turned into weeks and months, and when they returned to Jerusalem, the West was under the control of the new Israeli state. They were not allowed back in. So they only went back after 1967, another war when this time Israel captured the remaining eastern part of Jerusalem. Wilhelmine hoped perhaps to reclaim their houses, but it was not to be.
Of course, we always had hopes that we'd get back our houses, but nothing doing. Rule present, absent. We are present here to pay taxes and everything, but absent to get back our property.
In 1957, the apartment in the house where Wilhelmine's grandparents used to live was bought by Reuven and Ilana Tsur. Reuven was born into a Hungarian-speaking Jewish family in a town in today's Romania. They survived the war, although they lost many close relatives in the Holocaust. And in early 1949, they emigrated to the new Israel. Reuven studied at university in Jerusalem and married, and then the couple were looking for an apartment when one day an agent showed them the house in Talbiyeh.
And I only saw the palm trees from the outside, and I said, this must be a mistake. That couldn't be all that beautiful. It was empty, and nobody wanted it.
And so they made the flat their home and thought nothing of its previous owners. But then came the 1967 war, and Ilana had a feeling that the Palestinians who once lived there might return.
And sure enough, after a few weeks, comes a very prominent gentleman wearing a suit, an English suit, and looking good. And he said, okay, my parents lived here, and I would like to see the apartment. Emotionally, I felt awkward.
The man was Wilhelmine's uncle, Victor. And there were more visits in the years that followed, all remarkably amicable. But until now, there has been no resolution of the broader Palestinian refugee issue. There were around 700,000 refugees who fled or were forced out in 1948, and today there are 4.5 million. Like most Israelis, Reuven and Ilana say that to allow the Palestinians back would be unacceptable.
That's impossible, that is to say. That decision to bring them back, to let them back, is synonymous with deciding to do away with the Jewish state.
But, like most Palestinians, Wilhelmine insists on their right to one day return.
And this is our land. We have the right to come back to our home.
That was The Guardian's Rory McCarthy from Jerusalem. Each week, one of our readers or listeners provides a slice of life from his or her part of the world. This week, Elizabeth Hallett explains how walking her dog in China has given her unusual access behind police lines.
The view from our fifth-floor balcony is beautiful at this time of year. The trees in the gardens opposite have burst into leaf, and the muscala trees are already dangling, long trails of fragrant, cream-coloured blossom. Black and white magpies swoop and chatter in the branches. Woodpeckers are often heard, and a couple of weeks ago I even saw a pair of courting hoopoes. But last Saturday we stood on the balcony watching a rather different scene. Police vehicles were whizzing up and down our street, and in addition to the guards outside the embassy gates, there seemed to be an unusual number of uniformed men ambling about or reclining in their cars. A plastic cordon was tied across the road, and a couple of soldiers were hanging around, stopping passers-by. It was lunchtime, and time to take the dog out for a walk and check out what was going on. On my way out of our compound, I asked one old guy what was going on. "Student protest," he grumbled. "It's those wretched French." The French are in deep disgrace, having, as many people here believe, brought shame on our sacred flame when an anti-China, pro-Tibet protests disrupted the Olympic torch relay in Paris not so long ago. So now, apparently, patriotic students were on their way to vent their anger outside the French embassy, not 100 metres from where we live. It was all getting quite interesting, and I pushed my way through rows of police and soldiers to the end of the road, and, dog under my arm, ducked under the barrier ribbon, expecting to see hordes of students bearing down upon our neighbourhood. But nothing appeared to be happening, so I started ducking back under the cordon, but found myself confronted by a white-gloved hand thrust out to block my way. "Passport," demanded the police officer in English. I said I didn't have it on me. "Well, you can't come through." I said I lived just up the road and pushed my way in. The officer followed after. "Passport," he said again, not smiling. Once again I said I didn't have it. "Poxy foreigner," he was probably thinking, but decided not to pursue that line of questioning any further. Then he looked down at the dog. "Is it registered?" he demanded. "Yes, it was," I replied smugly. He wasn't going to let it go at that. By this time we were talking in Chinese. "Well, I must be off," I said. "I'm just taking the dog for a walk." "Why do you take the dog out now?" he persisted. "We Chinese only take our dogs out twice a day, once in the morning, once in the evening." "I take him out 3 times a day, I said. "People work at lunchtime. Why do you take him out now?" My goodness, he wasn't giving up. I gave him a withering look. "But it's the weekend, isn't it?" My little moment of triumph. He backed off, and the dog and I wandered back home, marvelling at the pettinesses of the PC plods of this world.
That was Elizabeth Hallett from Beijing. That's all for this week. This podcast was presented by Jim Falzerano. John Dennis will be back next week. The program was produced by Ian Chambers. Thanks for listening.